Goddag og velkommen til Langsomme Samtaler. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Vi er her på Langsomme Samtaler-redaktionen i lang tid meget gerne ville tale med en, der kunne forklare os, hvordan opbakningen og opfattelsen af konflikten mellem Israel og Palæstina har udviklet sig i USA i de sidste 50 år. Hvordan det i 60'erne var en sag for den amerikanske borgerrettighedsbevægelse at støtte israelerne, mens det i det 21. århundrede er en sag for den amerikanske borgerrettighedsbevægelse at støtte palæstinenserne. Hvilke brud det giver anledning til mellem konflikterne, og hvad det betyder, at den israelske sag i USA er flyttet fra venstre til højrefløjen, og den palæstinensiske sag til gengæld er blevet særdeles prominent på den amerikanske venstrefløj. Det er nogle meget store forskydninger, som har fundet sted i holdninger mellem generationer og i opfattelse af verden, men det er ultimativt også forskydninger i magt. Og jeg kan ikke forestille mig nogen bedre til at forklare det for os, end den amerikansk-palæstinensisk-libanesiske professor i litteraturvidenskab, Sareh Magdisi. Sareh, han er født i USA af en far, som er palæstinenser, og en mor, som også er palæstinenser, og han er nevø af den største palæstinensiske forsker overhovedet, Edward Said. Familien flyttede fra USA, da han var lille, til Libanon, hvor han oplevede borgerkrigen der, og derfor har han også erfaring med krig, og han så Palæstina fra den libanesiske side, og derfor udviklede han hele sit forestillingsunivers om Palæstina. Så vendte han tilbage til USA, hvor han gjorde en stor akademisk karriere. Han er en berømt forsker inden for britisk romantisk litteratur fra 1800-tallet, og har blandt andet skrevet bogen Romantic Imperialism, Universal Empire and the Culture of Modernity. Men ved siden af det værk, så har Sareh Magdisi også et andet værk, som er hans intellektuelle bøger, som er en intellektuel tilgang til Palæstina-problematikken. Han udgav for nogle år siden Palestine Inside Out, An Everyday Occupation, som er en fantastisk beskrivelse af hverdagserfaringen af den israelske besættelse. For et par år siden, der udgav han Tolerance is a Wasteland, Palestine and the Culture of Denial, som beskriver, hvordan de to historier, den israelske historie og den palæstinensiske historie, slynger sig ind mellem hinanden, og hvis man bekræfter den ene, så fortrænger man den anden. Sareh Magdisis pointe er, at fordi den israelske historie har været magthistorien i relationen mellem de to, så er den palæstinensiske historie fortrængt til marginerne af kulturhistorien, og han viser helt konkret, hvordan nogle steder er blevet fuldstændig udslettet og overgroet med skov, som er der, hvor de palæstinensiske ruiner var. Og han fortæller, hvordan Israel har erobret den amerikanske venstrefløj historisk ved at føre en slags liberal propaganda for den israelske sag. Det er med andre ord en stor kulturhistorie, det er en aktuel politisk konflikt, og det er et kæmpestort moralsk dilemma og en sag for aktivister, som jeg konfronterer i det her interview med Sareh Magdisi. Thank you so much for joining us and taking your time talking to us. It's a real pleasure and a privilege.
Our pleasure. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
I'd like to start with your own history, because your mother is Palestinian, your father is Lebanese, and I believe you identify as American. In the beginning of Palestine Inside Out, there's a very fine little story where you describe your first encounter with Palestine, the word, and then later you see it in real life. Will you share with us how you started to learn about Palestine?
Yeah, like many Palestinians, like far too many Palestinians, you learn about Palestine from the outside, not from the inside. So in my case, I grew up in Beirut, and in school, you know, if you're in a geography or a history lesson, there's always a map on the, you know, in the classroom, and it has, you know, Syria and Lebanon and Jordan and so forth. And it always has what it said in Arabic, always occupied Palestine, Palestine al-Muhtalla. And I was always intrigued by this, you know, this strange country. Like, why is it called Muhtalla? I mean, I was a kid, obviously, you know, trying to figure these things out. Why is it called Muhtalla? Why is that country different from all the other Arab countries, for one thing? So it's this idea that exists kind of, you know, in an abstraction in your head. And then I grew up during the civil war in Lebanon. And so it was often, you know, through my childhood, impossible to get down to the south because of the circumstances. And I remember the first time when I went down to the south of Lebanon and looked into northern Palestine, into the Galilee. And it was extraordinary because for the first time ever in my life, anyway, you know, I was able to connect this, what had been an abstraction, with the physical reality of this space, you know, beautiful countryside and forests, about which I'm sure we'll come back and talk about the forests later. But I was a kid then at that point still, you know, I didn't know how evil those forests actually are. But, you know, from the naive perspective of childhood, it looked beautiful, you know. But even with or without the forest, it's just seeing Palestine, being able to point to Palestine, being able to say that's Palestine. And I've been back to the border many times since then, as an adult as well. And, you know, there are places in the south of Lebanon where the border, what's called the blue line, is sort of negotiated. And it's very unclear, you know, sometimes the Israelis claim this is the line. Sometimes we say this is the line. It's complicated to draw exactly where the line is. And there are places where, you know, you can almost walk into what Lebanon claims is Palestine, but the Israelis for some reason don't. Or there are these weird gaps and sort of omissions in the line and so forth. And, you know, it's extraordinary to say, well, this is, I'm touching Palestine, you know, because as I said, it's the concretization of what had been in your head until then, an abstraction.
Your parents were both scholars and I believe invested in the Palestine courses. What was the discourse in the home where you grew up about Palestine?
Well, my parents are still both, I mean, they're retired, but they're both still scholars. The discourse was one of, well, first of all, it was during wartime, of course. So, you know, anybody who grows up in a war grows up in circumstances where you quickly realize that politics and history it's not something that happens in textbooks or on, you know, TV screens. It's something that happens to you in real life. So there's a thirst to know, what is this war about? Where did this come from? Why are we living under these circumstances and so on? And Palestine was always the key to everything. If you want to understand, I mean, even to this day, if you want to understand anything in the region running roughly from Morocco all the way across North Africa, down the east side of Africa, all the way through the Middle East, Yemen, all the way to Afghanistan and beyond, Palestine is the key. It's the key to everything. I mean, it's that disruption is the key that explains the kind of political transformation and trauma and endless, endless violence across the entire region. And, you know, because of this, not just the Zionist project to transform what had been a multicultural, multilinguistic, multi-confessional land into a state with a single identity, a Jewish state, but also the endless European and American support for this project, as we're seeing now in Gaza, of course, to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars in support and weapons and so forth. This hammering to transform Palestine into something that it never was, you know, a monolith in terms of culture and politics and religion and identity, spreads across the region. So growing up, you quickly want to understand, what is this about? Where did this come from? So Palestine was always there. My parents didn't work academically on Palestine. My mother wrote two amazing books, one called Beirut Fragments, which is a memoir of her as a civilian, as a mother, you know, raising us during the war in Lebanon. My father is an economist, so he's very interested in the political economy of democracy and post-Civil War economies and this kind of thing. But my mother's second book, I should say, was called Teta, Mother and Me. It's about three generations of Arab women, her grandmother, her mother, herself, you know, spanning, of course, well, that's half the point of the book, really, is in a way that until very recently, there were no borders as such between Palestine, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, Egypt, and so forth. So that my mother's family growing up, they would come and go across all those borders. You know, there was nothing, it was normal, you know, to go from Beirut to Jerusalem was a couple of hours in a car. It wasn't a very big deal. It seems unimaginable now, but Palestine has always been close to her heart and hence to all of our hearts in a way, but also to our political and historical understanding.
I think something that for many, at least here in Denmark, but I think in America as well, it's a little bit different because you have so many veterans in America, is an abstraction, is still war. You know, a lot of people who are voting for politicians who are supporting the war that we are seeing, or in your case, American case, even paying for it and tying it to the support for Ukraine. For many of them, war is an abstraction. My wife, she's from Iran, so she grew up with the Iran-Iraq war, and she has a very, very different attitude to what's happening than most other people here. And I was wondering, you grew up in another kind of war, that is, but still, and I know it can be very personal, but I think it's okay to ask you about it since you mentioned it in your book yourself. How did that shape you?
Well, anybody who, I mean, you're right, Bruna, anybody who experiences war, you're separated out. You belong to a particular community that's ultimately never really reconcilable with people who have not experienced war, in the sense that experience is transformative. It's utterly transformative. When you see what happens in war, you know, it just changes how you think about the entire world. And in my case, seeing war, first of all, led me to, first of all, never want there to be war ever to anybody ever again. That was the first. I mean, if you experience war, you realize how awful and how inhuman war is. And so in my case, it was this push to want to end war, you know. But the second thing is that you realize, well, what is war about? And you realize, as you're saying there, there's a difference between the way in which people talk about war, or for that matter, the way people talk about politics, as though there's a series of abstractions, as opposed to the actual human lived reality, either of war or of politics or of both, you know. So when people talk, for example, about the Israeli conflict with the Palestinian people, it's often in very, very abstract terms, like do this and move this and sign this and these lines and those lines and move people here. That's all very abstract. But we're talking about, when you talk about real people in actual material circumstances, it's a totally different kind of thing. And it's very, very difficult it shouldn't be difficult in principle, but it is difficult for too many people, I think, to understand what it is that they're supporting when they support, for example, a policy that leads to more and more and more war. For example, just to take the case of the US, other than Palestine, the US, I think people here don't realize, I think the overwhelming majority of Americans have no idea that in the 20 plus years of wars, never mind the rest of American history, which is also brutal and violent, but just in the past 20 years in living memory of American wars and invasions and bombardments and so on, almost 5 million people have been killed and about 40 million people have been displaced from their homes in more than a dozen countries. Americans have, by and large, no idea that that's what their country has done to all these other people, because it's an abstraction. It exists, it's somewhere far away that they don't see it. Or if they see it, they see it through the optic of warped, you know, television or cinema or journalistic coverage. And they don't, it's hard for them to grapple with the actual reality of what it is that they have endorsed politically, whether they want to or not.
You're a scholar in British literature, English literature, prose and poetry from the 18th and 19th century. This is where your professional academic work is. But you've also written a couple of very, very good books, and I would say different from a lot of other books about Palestine. They're both very originally. How did you come to become intellectually engaged in the Palestine cause? Because that wasn't a given that you would be that with your academic background.
That's a great question, Runa. So it's a bit strange, because I guess you could say the professional scholarship that I work on is indeed on British literature and culture in the 18th and 19th century, and it's moving more towards the 20th century too. And so at face value, it has nothing to do with Palestine at all. But actually, my work on British literature and culture has a lot to do with colonialism, with imperialism, with modernity, with modernization, with the relationship between modernization and racism and imperialism and so forth. So there is at a sort of theoretical level, there are kind of ways in which these two projects inform one another. But my projects on Palestine they've arisen from personal commitment. And I've been able to kind of bring my scholarly training to writing about Palestine, you know, to use I know how to use archives, I know how to use references, I know how to do research, I know how to write. And so I use my scholarly capacities in this pursuit of a project that means so much to me, and not just to me, to the world at large, I think, too. But it's interesting also that when you work on Palestine, it makes you also sensitive to certain things that took place in British culture. One of the formative moments in my own appreciation of that, for example, was in the 18th century, basically, it's hard to describe it, but basically, in a nutshell, the British state kind of acquired control over Western and Northern Scotland, the Scottish Highlands. And part of what that control involved was a kind of privatization of what had been clan-held property and the transformation of clan chiefs into basically landlords. And there was extraordinary violence through that process, which involved the displacement of huge numbers of people from their land. A very similar thing happened in London. So my book, Making England Western, I have a whole chapter about London. And part of what the concern of that book, of that chapter is about the transformation of central London in the 19th century, which also involved the kind of clearing of whole populations from the center of the metropolis in order to make London a more Western, modern, you know, sophisticated kind of urban metropolis. And so as a Palestinian, when you see any narrative about huge numbers of people being forcibly displaced from their homes, of course you see it, it clicks, you know, something clicks and you realize it's not the same story, but there are commonalities there. And there's a kind of, I would say there's a set of cross-referencing that goes on between these two different projects that I work on, even if they're not the same. And I, you know, I do maintain a distinction between them in different kinds of ways.
Yeah, because it's so like there's almost a historical overlap with the Balfour Declaration and the British history going up to the beginning of the creation of the State of Israel, if we take it back to Churchill. I was wondering, when you're invested in the Palestinian cause in America, growing up in Lebanon, how did you feel in America? Did you feel there was, I lived in America when I was young, coming from Denmark, I thought there was a lot more understanding of the Palestinian cause here in Denmark, actually, than I saw in America. I was surprised to see how most people on the left would not identify with the Palestinians. When I lived in Pennsylvania, that was in the early 90s. How did you experience that?
Yeah, very similarly. But this is a big part of what we're seeing right now. America has changed enormously. So when I came back, so I was born in Washington and I grew up in Beirut, and I came back to finish my last year of high school and then university and, you know, graduate school and so on. But so when I came back to the U.S. after the siege of Beirut in 1982, I lived there through the siege of Beirut in 1982. Then at the end of it, I was sort of plucked out of Beirut and put into a boarding school in Massachusetts. And you can imagine, I kind of went sort of half crazy, as anybody would, going from one experience to the other, because suddenly I was in a place where not only was there no support or very little support for Palestine and the Palestinians, but there was a lot of support, kind of hardwired support for the Israelis and for Zionism, and, you know, which was very difficult to do. But if I look back now over whatever that is, 30, 40 years, whatever it is, what you realize looking back is that the arguments we were having back then was, you know, for example, do the Palestinians exist? Is there a Palestinian people? That's where we were back then, to try and establish that there is a Palestinian people. I mean, in America, I'm talking about, you know, to make Americans understand that Palestinians do exist. They are a people. They have rights. That's where the debate was back then. And now look at where the debate is now. Most opposition, most people who are trying to stifle Palestinian aspirations, their position now is the two-state solution. I mean, that's, which is problematic for all kinds. You can talk about it if you want to, but sure. think of where we've gone. Like, yeah. We've gone for in the 1980s, it was like Palestinians don't even exist, to now the kind of opposition position generally is, oh, there should be a two-state solution. Of course, what that means is a whole other set of questions, but in principle, at least, there's at least the verbal recognition that Palestinians have rights. But you're right, Runo, also, that historically, the left, not just in the US, by the way, but in Europe as well, historically, the left was always closer to the Zionist cause than the right, historically speaking, going back to the 50s and 60s. I mean, after all, the Soviet Union, for example, endorsed the creation of the Israeli state, right? That's back then. The Communist Party supported the Israeli state. European Communist parties did. I have European friends on the left who, when they were in their 20s or late teens, would go to kibbutz because that was like cool sort of, you know, socialist, allegedly kind of socialist thing to do and so forth. And that's what people did. So there was this affiliation, but the world has changed. It's changed enormously. It's even before the current crisis in Gaza, attitudes have been changing because people have been seeing the Israelis for what they actually are and the Israeli state for what it actually is. And obviously what we're seeing now is the culmination of that set of transforming, you know, sets of awarenesses. But people now, I mean, you know, especially the youth, it's overwhelming how much support there is for the Palestinian cause among youth and even among many, many, many Democratic voters in the U.S. So that's one thing I track in the book, is in the book, Palestine, Tolerance is a Wasteland, which we can get back to if you want. But like part of the story there is that if we look back over 40 or 50 years, Zionism and Israel have gone from being a left-wing cause to a right-wing cause. From having been associated with socialism and this kind of thing, the Israeli state is now associated with militarism, with violence, with racism, with xenophobia, all the things that appeal, I don't know why, but they do, but they appeal to the right wing, whether in Europe or in the US. And hence we see a different set of network of alliances developing between the far right, revanchist, violent, xenophobic, ethno-nationalist, etc., whether in Europe or in the US, and Zionism. I mean, that's a much more natural alliance, as far as I'm concerned, than a left wing, because I've never really understood this idea of people who can be on the left and yet support Zionism. How can you, for example, how can you support women's rights or gender equality or racial equality and care about the environment and all these other, you know, positive progressive values, and yet you still support this vicious apartheid colonialist, you know, state? It never made sense to me. It has to do, of course, with denial, which we can come back to. But anyway, the point is that attitudes have changed enormously since I first came back to the US in the early 1980s, where we were then to where we are now. They're different universes.
There's something very interesting in your book. I wasn't aware of it. Maybe that's common knowledge in America, that mainstream in the civil rights movement was very sympathetic to the Zionist project. You say that Malcolm X was the big exception, but Du Bois and Martin Luther King were sympathetic to the Zionist movement. And I think there must have been a big shift here from the civil rights movement in the 60s. And I think some of what we are seeing now has also been prepared by Black Lives Matter. It seems that there's a generation that has become more sensitive to the sufferings of the Palestinian people and are more focused on racism and colonialism than the heritage of Holocaust. Am I right in assuming that there's a shift here within sort of what you call the Black movement that's been crucial to the Palestinian cause in America?
Oh, absolutely. There was, so in the heyday of the civil rights movement in the U.S., for example, the labor movement, the women's movement, a lot of the Black civil rights, not all, but a lot of them, activists and so on, were very sympathetic to Zionism and the Israeli cause. That began to change. Even in the 1960s, it began to change. For example, the Black Panthers were obviously sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. And then Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, the boxer. There were all kinds of figures leaning towards the, you know, support for Palestine, and more than leaning and endorsing the Palestinian struggle for self-determination. But the transformation from where we were then to where we are now is remarkable. And as you're saying, Runa, part of what you see now in American understandings of race is that the Palestinian cause not only has to be understood alongside, let's say, the cause for Black rights in America, but also a whole range of other struggles as well. Immigrant rights, for example, or prison reform, or police abolition, or, of course, the rights of indigenous people in the Americas as well. And so there's a sense of a convergence. People now, especially again, young people, understand the Palestinian cause in the terms of contemporary struggles, like Black Lives Matter, like indigenous land rights struggles, like the struggles for queer rights, all the whole range of struggles. Those are the terms in which young people understand the Palestinian struggle to be located in those terms. One of the sort of startling examples of that was in the summer of 2014, when, as you know, Gaza was going through one of its routine rounds of punishment by the Israelis. And heavy bombardment, and 1,400 or 1,500 people, which seems, it's not nothing, of course, it's terrible, but compared to what's happening now, it's unfortunately nothing, but awful in 2014. And that was the same summer in which, you may remember in St. Louis, or in a suburb of St. Louis, Michael Brown was killed by the police. And there was this convergence between, in that moment, there was a kind of convergence between Palestinian activists, whether in the West Bank or Gaza, and in fact on the ground in St. Louis itself, with Black rights activists and the Black Lives Matter, there's this moment where they realized we're fighting the same fight, partly among other reasons, not just ideologically or historically or racially, but also infrastructurally, in the sense that, for example, the St. Louis police force, which used, of course, grotesque, you know, extraordinary violence against Black people, as many U.S. police forces do, was trained by the Israelis, at least partly trained by the Israelis. They use some of the same equipment as the Israelis do. And same thing with the Minneapolis police force when it comes to George Floyd a few years later, right? So there's a sense that Black activists in America realize we're up against a police force that uses some of the same equipment as the Israelis who are patrolling the West Bank and Gaza. And hence, there's a commonality also, like literally at the infrastructural level, not just at the kind of rhetorical or ideological or historical or political level. There's a kind of convergence there that took place that I think helped both struggles realize their common affinity, essentially to a common enemy, which is the enemy here in this case is the revanchist state with its racial violence and its dispossession and brutalization and investments in all the wrong things, police and prisons, as opposed to infrastructure, healthcare, education, and so on.
I think that, and that is becoming very, very important here in Europe. You see, it's very interesting, actually. You see, I wouldn't say a Muslim population, but people from Muslim countries, like my own kids, they have become aware of themselves as political subjects through Black Lives Matter. So it's like they're in a community here, and they see Black Lives Matter. They see that, oh, we can be allied with the cool people. My son literally said that when Black Lives Matter came. It was the first time that the cool people were on the side of the anti-racist struggle here. And I think that actually motivated them to see these huge demonstrations that we're seeing here now, which is interesting. But I want to turn to your book because Tolerance is a Wasteland is very, very good at making people like me understand how liberals could be supportive of Israel for such a long time and how we could have this phenomenon, PEP, progressive except for Palestine. And at the core of the book is a story about the construction of a Jewish museum on a Muslim cemetery that is so significant. And will you share the story of this museum with us?
It's an extraordinary story. So there's an institution here in Los Angeles called the Museum of Tolerance. And it's a place, it's not exactly a Holocaust museum, but it's a very Zionist institution for which the Holocaust represents, of course, the ultimate kind of trauma that no other people could experience anything like the trauma of the Holocaust. So although they're open to, you know, exhibits about, let's say, of course, very carefully curated exhibits about, for example, the violence in Darfur, understood and narrated from a very, very particular kind of angle, of course, for clear political purposes and motivations. But anyway, so they decided in the early 2000s, they wanted to open a branch in Jerusalem. And so the municipality of Jerusalem said, here, you can have this plot of land to build your Jerusalem branch on. And so the plot was what it seemed to be, what they called the parking lot that was adjacent to Israel's Independence Park, as it's called. And then the museum, as I said, is based here in LA. So they got the very prominent LA-based architect, Frank Gehry, who's designed massive buildings. I'm sure you know his work all over the world, like the Walt Disney Concert Hall here in Los Angeles, the Bilbao Museum, the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, and many other structures around the world. He's famous for his titanium-clad structures. Anyway, so they got him, and they pursued this project. And then shortly after the project was initiated, the Muslim community in Palestine, in Jerusalem specifically, pointed out, but that's the site of a cemetery. In fact, not just where they were building the museum, but Israel's so-called Independence Park. It's kind of amazing. It's built literally, Independence Park itself is built over the ruins, the desecrated remains of the same cemetery, right? So if you go to celebrate Israel's Independence Day in Israel's Independence Park in Jerusalem, you're literally picking your way through Muslim graves. It's sort of, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think that country desperately needs mass psychoanalysis which is interesting. But anyway, so the site turned out to be the site of this cemetery that had been in active use from the time of the Crusades up to 1948. I mean, I know people who have family members buried there, for example. And, you know, of course, everybody thought, well, you're not going to build a museum of tolerance on somebody else's graveyard. I mean, that's impossible, right? But of course, what happened was they persisted. They absolutely persisted. And so the project went ahead. Frank Gehry, after I had an argument with him in print, Frank in the journal Critical Inquiry, Frank Gehry dropped out of the project, thankfully. But they gave it to another architect, and then they had a fight with that guy, and they found another architect. It took about 20 years. But what's interesting is that, you know, they literally were exhuming skeletons and skulls and things like that and dumping them in cardboard boxes and, you know, getting rid of them, basically, in order to construct this monument to what they call tolerance, which is, of course, an abomination, because it's not, that's how much more intolerant can you be than to desecrate another people's cemetery to build this shrine? That's basically, although it says tolerance, if you look at the way in which they talk about the exhibitions, it's all about basically, it's a kind of homage to Zionism. It's basically an attempt to rewrite the history of the Jewish people in teleological ways that ends up with Zionism. In other words, to say all of Jewish history has always been going towards Zionism. And so that's what it is. So it's this, so even though it's called the Museum of Tolerance, it's actually a museum of Jewish history re-narrated as Zionist history, and yeah, built on the ruins of this Muslim cemetery. It's kind of, it's sort of extraordinary. And I mean, as you're saying, it formed the kernel of the book in that I was amazed that how could it be that so many, you know, so-called progressives, George Clooney is the most famous instance among them, who are affiliated with the museum here in LA, and he's done you know, voiceovers for some of their films, and he works with them very closely, as does his supposed human rights lawyer wife, Amal Clooney. So how could people like Clooney be connected with this appalling racist, violent, ethnic cleansing project? It's because he, of course, I mean, I don't know the guy, but I assume he's not being disingenuous. I assume he just doesn't know, in the same way that Frank Gehry didn't know, for example. Frank Gehry's politics are also pretty progressive. He didn't know. He was misinformed by these people. So there's a kind of, but part of what they do is they present this structure of, let's talk about tolerance. Let's focus so intently on this discourse, this self-congratulatory discourse of tolerance, that we don't, you know, our attention is pulled to this discourse of tolerance. So we're looking at that rather than at the cemetery that's been, from which the bodies have been disinterred and, you know, it's rummaged through and desecrated and so forth. And it's this, so what I'm interested in is that structure of a denial, a form of denial of the Palestinian presence in Jerusalem in this instance, but it's transacted not just by saying, oh, no, it's not a cemetery, but rather by, no, let's focus on tolerance. Look at tolerance. And it's the focus on tolerance that enables the denial by covering it up, literally, of the Muslim and Palestinian presence in Jerusalem in that particular instance.
And it really is an impressive discourse when I read your book, not impressive in a positive sense, but just in a neutral sense, that you can establish a discourse that is affirmation and denial at the same time. And I was not aware of this strategic liberal project of forestation as well, and this building, this entire it's an entirely liberal discourse, except from one thing, the Palestinians. Can you tell about this forest project? Because that is amazing as well.
It's extraordinary. So if you know, I'm sure it's the same in Europe, certainly here in the US, especially in Jewish communities, there's always this, going back to even to the 40s and 50s and 60s, fundraising specifically towards planting trees in Israel. So give a dollar to plant a tree in Israel, or plant trees, or there's a whole narrative that the Israelis, they present themselves to the West in terms of they're making the desert bloom, and they're, and now, of course, in the context of climate change, they're all eco-sensitive, and they're nourishing and watering and protecting the earth and all this kind of stuff. Whereas, of course, what they're doing is rummaging through somebody else's landscape and destroying it. But they present themselves in this very positive, virtuous kind of way. The thing about the forest in particular is that it's one of the focal points of the Jewish National Fund, which is a Zionist institution that actually predates the state itself, and it's kind of quasi-state status now. And so they raise all this money to plant these forests. And this is what they don't tell anybody, including above all the donors to this project of forestation. They plant their forests not only, but primarily over the ruins of Palestinian villages that were destroyed and depopulated during the Nakba of 1948. In other words, during the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948, when Zionist militias terrorized about 800,000 Palestinians from their homes, the rural landscape of towns and villages and so forth was left obviously abandoned and empty because people had been driven from their homes. And what was this new Jewish state going to do with this Arab landscape of villages with cultivated, you know, with olive and citrus and so on? They wanted to just to obliterate it, to rewrite the geography of the state, of the space, in terms of this new modern Jewish state that they had in mind, that they brought obviously from Europe. And so they obliterated the villages. Some of them were damaged during 1948, but many of them were actually demolished all the way into the 1950s and 1960s. They continued demolishing these villages. And then they planted these forests over the ruins. So you can literally go in these forests. I've been there. And you can see in between the trees that just as in Israel's Independence Park in Jerusalem, if you look between the behind the bushes, you're going to see Palestinian tombstones. In these forests, you see between the trees, you're going to see the ruins of homes. You might say, well, whose houses are these? And of course, none of the brochures about the forest or the signs or the, you know, the posters, they don't mention these villages at all, but they're all there. And part of the point is to make the villages disappear. So when you look at the landscape, you see these beautiful forests. They're actually not beautiful. They're very eerie, because you have forests in Europe. Obviously, we have forests in Lebanon and here in America. And forests are, you know, very biodiverse. There are all kinds of species. And these are like militarized forests. They're like armies of pine trees packed together. They look completely unnatural when you actually see them. And in between the trees, you see stone ruins, which are the ruins of Palestinian homes. So the point here, again, is the Israeli state and its so-called liberal institutions like the Jewish National Fund, which attract all this donor money from progressive and liberal communities in the West, they don't want you to think about the Nakba. They don't want you to think about the people expelled from their homes by terrorism and violence of the Israeli state. They want you to think about, and of course the ruins left behind. They want you to think about how wonderful Israel is. So don't look at the ruins, which you can't see unless you really are careful. Look at the forests. We make the landscape bloom. We make the desert bloom. We're bringing life to the desert and all this other kind of stuff. Again, it's a similar structure to that of the museum. Don't look here, look there, right? Don't look at the ruins or the people who were expelled. Don't look at the ethnic cleansing. Look at the forest. Support the forest. And of course, by lending your support to planting these trees, you are, whether you're aware of it or not, you are lending your support to a project of ethnic cleansing and home demolition. They're not selling it as such, they're selling it as a project of planting trees. So here you are, your innocent, wonderful little Western progressive self, and you're giving your money to support, and your political capital too, of course, to support a project of home demolition and ethnic cleansing. But that's not what you think you're doing. You think you're supporting this wonderful enterprise of making the desert bloom.
But this dual narrative, which you write in your book, is kind of over by, and it's from 2021, 2022. And of course, now it seems like radically over, if we could say that. You know, this appeal has gone with this, I think it's absolutely, this area of denial is over, is a phrase that you use in the book. And it's obvious a challenge to the PEPs of the world today, because it's so obvious. But this also, when you're writing the book, you have these literary, and I studied literature as well, you have these literary scholar capacities that could contribute politically, because you say they use these words, but this is what they're showing, and this is what they're hiding. Now we're in a totally different situation where these capacities that you have and that I have, they seem less useful because it's so much about brutal force. How do you see, as where you're from, professionally, the critical strategies that could be efficient from here?
That's a great question. First of all, the dynamics, you're right, Runa, they have changed. That's the first thing to be said. I mean, people used to believe this kind of stuff about how innocent and how wonderful Israel is, and we can all go to a kibbutz and sit around the campfire and sing songs and toast marshmallows and wear Birkenstocks and eat granola and, you know, bathe in this kind of glow of the socialist paradise that of course it never was. But I don't think anybody does that anymore. I don't think anybody believes that stuff anymore. I mean, so Israel has over the past several years, it's been stripping all these layers of denial that I talk about in the book. It's been stripping them off, right? So, for example, in 2018, the Israeli parliament passed the Jewish nation state law, which is one of their basic laws. It has constitutional status, in other words. And it's racism is, it's previous forms of racism. The state was always juridically and legally and institutionally a racist enterprise from the beginning, but most of its racism was transacted subtly or, you know, de facto, not de jure, and, you know, very quietly and, you know, not explicitly, not like South Africa. South Africa had a name for its racism called apartheid. The Israelis never had, they were always very canny about that kind of thing, partly for the reasons we've been talking about. But in 2018, they stripped off all of the nonsense. They said, no, we really are. This really is a nakedly racial enterprise. And of course, they've been doing it much, much, much more ever since 2018, and now obviously up to the present catastrophe in Gaza. So I think any normal human being who looks at what's happening in Gaza, there is no way for any normal human being with a moral compass to look at what's happening in Gaza and still stand with the Israelis. It's impossible. I realize, having said that, there are some people who do support the Israelis, not just right-wing, you know, I think lunatics, but there are more normal people who do in fact support Israel, because that same structure of denial, it's residual, but it's still kind of there. And I think that's one thing we can do as literary scholars is to look at what are the structures of denial that persist, because they've changed a little bit. They're still there. They operate in different kinds of ways, but we need to pay our attention to it. But let's look at the big picture first. The big picture is the overwhelming majority of normal, moral human beings, and I think most people are normal and moral in that sense, you know, they're not going to support this enterprise anymore. I think the Israelis have been burning their incubator, which is the West. They've torched it. They've set fire to it. They're their oxygen generator. What you use the metaphor you want. You know, they couldn't exist without Western support. They've trashed that in this insanity that they've engaged in Gaza. But as we said, there are still some people, you have them in Europe, we have them here in the US, who say, and what do they say? The people who are supporting the genocide in Gaza, they are not, in their own minds, they're not supporting genocide. They don't talk about the genocide. They're saying, look at October 7th. Notice it's the same structure as the forest or the Museum of Tolerance. Look. Yeah, but what about this genocide? No, don't look at the genocide. Look at this. Look at October 7th. Look at what happened on October 7th. Let's focus here. And you say, yeah, but what about the hospitals and the children and the 13,000 and the 30,000 people killed? No. Don't look at that. Look at this. Look at October 7th. It's like they're fetishizing October 7th. It's a very similar structure to the one I talk about in the book, except it's negative in this. It's not, let's look at this beautiful positive value. Let's look at this negative value. You know, what happened on October 7th. And of course, as you dig deeper into it, this is where literary skills come to the fore. Uh-huh. What did happen on October 7th? In fact, we don't know. Nobody knows what actually happened on October 7th, because the Israelis are doing everything they can to cover up the actuality. There have been many, 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 many reports in the Israeli press, in the Hebrew press, and even in the English language press in Israel that show there's no question whatsoever that some proportion, now what proportion exactly, we don't know, but some proportion, a significant proportion, of the Israeli civilian casualties inflicted on October 7th were inflicted by Israeli helicopter gunships and by Israeli tanks firing, as they always do wherever they go, indiscriminately at anything that moves. That's their MO, that's how they operate. But those stories don't make it, for whatever reason, they don't make it to the mainstream Western press, right? I'm sure you saw that story in the New York Times about Hamas's program of rape on October 7th, a systematic campaign of rape and sexual violence. And yet when you look at, well, what is the actual evidence for this? There is no evidence. There's literally no evidence whatsoever. There are allegations made by, including, for example, among other things, the same organization that said it had pictures of the famous 40 beheaded babies on October 7th. And it turns out there were no 40 beheaded babies. There are no photographs. It never happened. And now the Israelis themselves admit, yeah, that didn't actually happen. It's the same people who came up with that story, came up with this story about the rape on October 7th. And so if you look at that New York Times story with the skills of a literary, or really any other kind of scholar, not even a literary, honestly, anybody who has a functioning brain can look at this and say, but you're making this, all of these assertions, where is the evidence for what you're claiming is a systematic program on one of the most, you know, most photographed and videotaped days in human history, right? Where's the evidence for it? It's not there, but let's focus on it nevertheless, right? And so this, that's, I think, is an extraordinary structure. And not to say that, that terrible things didn't happen on October 7th, they did. And we could go into the history of that and why and here, you know, and we could talk about that in detail. But my point is that when people are supporting other than right-wing fantasists, when more kind of mainstream people are supporting what happened on October 7th, and I think there are fewer and fewer and fewer of them, when they do, it's in terms of, when they support the genocide, it's in terms of October 7th. Let's focus on October 7th and occlude, blot out, forget, not even look at. It relieves us of the pressure to look at what's been happening ever since October 7th, which is the destruction of 85% of Gaza's housing, the destruction of every single university campus in the Gaza Strip. They've all been destroyed, many of them blown up with demolition charges, not by bombardment, you know. Every single hospital has been damaged or destroyed in Gaza. 250 schools have been destroyed. 90% of the population has been displaced. 30,000 people officially killed, but there's 10 or 11,000 people under the rubble. They've been killed. They've suffered slow, agonizing deaths too. So we're talking about 100 and 150,000 people between killed, wounded, missing, disappeared. Torture and rounding up people and stripping them naked and abusing them. And the Israelis, there are videos of, have you seen them too? I'm sure Israeli soldiers urinating on Palestinian bodies and dragging naked men across the ground where they're blindfolded and bound and all incredible, incredible violence that we're seeing. Let's not look at any of that. Let's talk about October 7th. I personally find that a kind of sickness, morally and intellectually and politically speaking. But that's kind of the last grasp that supporters of Israel and the West, that's what they have to resort to. You know, and I think, but the important thing is, I think that's a minority. I think the overwhelming majority of people are intelligent, they're sentient, they can think, they can see, they can feel. They're not blindfolded, they're not stupid, and they're aware of what's happening. And I think the support for Israel, what's left of it now in the West, will continue to be this kind of residual, revanchist, right-wing, racist, xenophobic set of structures, which are strong, by the way. I'm not saying that they're not there. I mean, you have these forces in Europe, we have them in the US, and they're powerful and they're worrying. I'm not dismissing them, but it's not what it used to be. That's kind of the point.
I spoke to Peter Beinart, I think he was reading your book or helping you at some point with the book. At least he's thanked somewhere in the book a couple of months ago. And he made, he made the same analogy, of course, between South Africa and Israel and the apartheid point. And he also said, well, we're at a point now where the global support for the Israeli occupation is at an all-time low. And it's going one way. But then he said, well, when he compared it to South Africa, where he grew up, he said there was one major difference, is that this global support that you'd have outside the country does not have a legitimate moral center that you can support within Palestine, as it had in South Africa with the ANC. Where he said in the ANC, you could have all the protests in the American campus. They could say, well, we support the ANC. That was kind of a progressive liberal movement that you could say, well, you lead the liberation. The Palestinian cause in the occupied territory, West Bank and Gaza, don't have the same what you call ethical, legitimate center that you can support. And that's kind of tragic at this moment where you have huge global support.
Runa, I disagree with that. I disagree with that assessment. First of all, I disagree with it historically in terms of South Africa. The ANC was considered by Western governments to be a terrorist organization and Nelson Mandela a terrorist. Until the very, 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 very end. Then, as though by magic, they suddenly realized, oh, actually, no, it's not a terrorist organization. They're not, we're going to change that designation and so on. They may even, by the way, I don't even know if they ever actually changed. I mean, I presume they did. But the point is, so there was this designation of this outfit as a terrorist organization and Mandela as a terrorist and so on. The last second, Western governments changed their tune and suddenly the ANC came to be. Now, in terms of popular support, it's true that people could cathect onto the ANC and say, we support Free Nelson Mandela. There are all these songs, you can probably sing them as well as I can, about let's free Nelson Mandela and so forth. And that's true. And but the Palestinians do have an equivalent, in effect, which is the BDS movement. And you could say, well, that's not a political party. Well, fine. So it's not a political party, but it's still, it's a set of principles that Palestinians uniformly have asked the world community since 2005 to endorse, which is boycotts, divestments, and sanctions, exactly modeled on the ones in South Africa. In fact, they're more lenient than the ones, than the boycott campaign in South Africa. Because as you may remember, the boycott campaign in South Africa was absolute. Like, you know, it was no sports teams, for example, no, they didn't, they, South Africa couldn't send teams to the World Cup, et cetera, right? The Israelis still do. I think they should be banned from the World Cup. I think they shouldn't be playing in UEFA. Thankfully, they never make it to the Champions League teams. But even in the Europa League, they shouldn't be there. They shouldn't be, racist regimes should not have participation in world sports. I think all of the campaign for boycotts and sanctions will accelerate after the immediate crisis that we're in right now, because the focus right now is on let's save as many lives, if it's even possible to save lives at all, and it's rebuild, and it's focus on the crisis that's happening now. Eventually, the bombing and killing in Gaza is going to stop, and I think there's going to be a massive boost in support for boycotts, divestments, and sanctions, which is the nonviolent mechanism. And I think, to my mind, it is exactly the moral and political equivalent of the ANC, that that the ANC played, you know, the role that it played as a kind of moral anchor, to use Peter's terms, in the 1980s, you know, when at the height of the campaign against apartheid in South Africa. People want to know, well, what can we support? Well, you can support, you can boycott yourself, and you can support the divestment of your companies, your schools, your businesses, your education, your establishments from racism, which is what Israel represents. So everybody can participate in that, as they did in the case of South Africa. We have to remember also, when we look back at the South African experience about the boycott campaign, the Western governments, above all the US and UK governments, supported the apartheid regime until the last second. Only at the very last second did they change. It was ordinary people of goodwill in Europe and the US and countries around the world, of course, all of Africa, the rest of Africa, of course, that goes without saying. And third world, that they always boycotted to begin with. But the white governments, you know, the US and the UK above all, supported South African apartheid to the very end. It was ordinary people who made governments change. And they did so through this campaign of boycotts and sanctions. And I think we're going to see exactly the same thing unfold, especially after the wake, in the wake of the catastrophe that the Israelis have inflicted on Gaza. I think that's the next stage of the struggle. And I think BDS will occupy the same kind of political and moral role that the ANC did in the anti-apartheid struggle in the case of South Africa.
I actually met the leader of the BDS movement here in Copenhagen in October, because there was a social movement conference. And I agree with you, he could be, they could be the political... Yeah,
Runa, by the way, there is no leader. That's the other thing about the BDS movement, is it's decentralized. So another answer to, like another historical answer to give to Peter's objection is, who are, you know, but people often say, well, who's the Palestinian Mandela? Well, the Palestinian Mandela has been assassinated about 100 times over, because that's what the Israelis do. You know, so it's not like the South Africans were innocent, obviously, and they jailed Mandela for 40 years. But the point is, you know, who could have been the possible Palestinian Mandelas? Well, maybe they were one of the 30,000 people killed in Gaza in the past few weeks, right? Who knows who that could have been? Somebody, maybe Ghassan Kanafani, the brilliant Palestinian novelist and intellectual and writer, assassinated by the Israelis in Beirut in the 1970s. Maybe he would have been the Palestinian Mandela. Who knows? The Israelis killed him. We didn't get a chance to find out what he could have become. So I don't think we should look necessarily to political individuals or to political parties, because individuals can be assassinated and parties can be co-opted, as has happened, for example, with the PLO and the PA in the case of Palestine. Whereas a movement like BDS, which has no leaders, it's a set of principles, it's a set of ideas. It's very, very hard to eradicate or co-opt or, you know, capture in some way a movement that's based on moral political principles. So I actually have much more faith in BDS than I do in a political party that can easily be co-opted or captured or coerced by the Israelis.
And there are lots of avenues for supporting the BDS here from the US or here from Denmark. And they're not illegal in Denmark. They've been illegal in many places, and many have worked against them. I think that's a wonderful place to end. Sari, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work and your inspiration. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Runa. Your questions are extraordinary, and I thank you for all your interest in the Palestinian question too.
Det var så min samtale med Sari McDeasy. Hvis man gerne vil læse hans bøger, så kan jeg anbefale Tolerance is a Wasteland, som var den, vi det meste af tiden refererede til, men også Palestine Inside Out, som er en lidt ældre bog, som vi også talte om. Den her samtale var redigeret og produceret af vores fuldstændig pragtfulde kammerat og hjælper Albert Kuhlmann. I næste uge, der skal vi tage fat om filosofien. Der vender vi tilbage til et af vores yndlingstemaer her på Langsom Samtaleredaktion. Et tema, som vi ikke opholder os særlig meget ved, men som til gengæld gennemsyrer alt, hvad vi laver, nemlig den tyske filosof Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. Jeg skal tale med den amerikanske tænker Robert Pippin, som er en af de største Hegel-forskere i dag, og som netop har udgivet en ny bog, der hedder The Culmination, som handler om det punkt, hvor Hegel ikke længere har ret, og hvor man bliver nødt til at gå til den sorte Heidegger for at forstå, hvor det er, moderniteten støder på sin grænse. Alt det, kære lytter, det tager vi fat på i næste uge. Tak fordi du lyttede med. Jeg håber også, du lytter med næste uge.